Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Emma Vigeland. Sam Seether is on vacation this week. This week on Ring of Fire, Gayan Hye-eo, Executive Director of the American Indian Law Alliance, joins me to discuss the devastating revelations about the mass unmarked graves of children at the abusive Indigenous residential schools and what repair for the Indigenous looks like in North America. And Heather Digby Parton will help us break down all the top news items of the week. Thank you to everyone who has subscribed to the free show, and a special thank you to everyone who decided to support the show and upgrade to the member podcast. Why upgrade to the member show, you ask? Well, for starters, you get bonus content you won't hear anywhere else. Head over to rofpodcast.com and sign up today. This week's bonus content, I speak with Simon Brown about the anti-intellectualism in the Republican Party and how it's quite strategic in attempting to keep higher education as an elite enterprise and not letting in too many plebeians through that door. A lot of Afghanistan in the news this week as the August 31st deadline that Biden has set is quickly approaching. But what's also approaching is the California recall election and the possibility that Gavin Newsom could be recalled and some loon like Larry Elder could win. Here to talk about all of this and more is Heather Parton Digby, the proprietor, as Sam might say, of the blog Hullabaloo. Thank you so much, Digby. Really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Yeah, so let's start actually with the California recall election, because you are in California. And, you know, I don't think that this has gotten the national attention that it probably deserves, given the severity of the outcome if some guy like Larry Elder was to win. And, you know, the polls are closer than I think Newsom's camp and the California Democratic Party and people in general might like. What's your sense on the ground there of what you're seeing?
Well, I think I wrote about this for Salon last spring, sort of an I had an optimistic take, you know, kind of, hey, this isn't Trump country. The COVID response has been, you know, competent. And, you know, things are working out here. The economy is doing okay. There's a big surplus and Newsom's going to spend a bunch of money, et cetera, et cetera. But it is closer than I thought it would be. And not because I think that Democrats are necessarily unhappy with Newsom. That's not the case. So the problem is that they're just not paying attention. And those who are, there's a big enthusiasm gap. Newsom in the last CBS poll had a 57% approval rating. That's not recall numbers, you know, especially in this polarized, you know, political state that we're in this country. So and he has a 60% approval rating on his handling of COVID. So there's more going on here. And I think it's important to explain to anybody who doesn't know how this works is that the California recall, I mean, this is an antediluvian, you know, kind of comes out of the progressive reforms of 1911. In California, that's how long it's been here. It never worked. They tried it many times, of course, to recall politicians, particularly governors. And it never worked until it happened in 2003 when Arnold Schwarzenegger was on the ballot. And I think you can probably guess why it worked then. He was up against a guy named Gray Davis, whose personality sounded just like his name. he was a very, very dull person. But the recall itself, it's a very weird system where, you know, they put, there's two things on the ballot. The first thing on the ballot says, do you want to recall Gavin Newsom? Yes or no? That's the first question. Then the second question is, who do you want to replace him? This is confusing to voters because they assume, you know, that they have to fill out both parts of the ballot, which they do not, and which the Democratic Party is encouraging them not to do. Just vote no. And no, we don't want to recall Gavin Newsom, and don't fill in any of the rest. And the reason is very simple. If for some reason Newsom doesn't reach 50% plus one, whoever comes in first on the rest of that ballot, and there are 46 people, all of them gadflies, none of them qualified. Every single one would be a disaster for the country, for the state. But whoever won of that, it could be somebody who wins 15% of the vote out of 47, right? Nobody knows who half these people are. They would become the governor. So the guy who gets 49.9% loses, and the person who gets 15% wins. I mean, that's undemocratic. It's insane, actually. And the Democrats really need to push to get this removed. It's in the state constitution, and so it's not that easy, but it has to be done because this is ridiculous. You have rich Republicans coming in when they can't win in this state because they are, you know, they make up what, 30% of the population. I mean, this is the beating heart of blue America here, right? And it's 40 million people. There are a lot of Democrats here and not that many Republicans. But they can use these undemocratic means. And just to make a long story short, the reason this is important is because if the Republicans are able to pull this off through lack of enthusiasm, interest, information, whatever on the part of the Democrats, this will end up being, you know, just a rallying cry for more undemocratic means. And we're seeing it happen all over the country in other states in other ways. I mean, they're not recalls. But there are, we're well aware of all the things that they're trying to do. The winning by any means necessary will become, you know, if you can beat Gavin Newsom in California, we can beat, you know, whomever in Georgia or Texas or Florida or wherever. So it's a big problem. You do not want to give them this win. And you don't, you know, we have a very, very elderly senator named Dianne Feinstein, who, if for some reason she is unable to fulfill her term, would be replaced by someone like Larry Elder, you know, a right-wing talk show host. I mean, this is
right.
That changes the Biden agenda is dead. Everything's done if that happens. So it's vitally important to the country that not just California, that this not happen. So, you know, I'm a little nervous, hopefully, because they've mailed out ballots to every registered voter in the state. You know, all anybody has to do is stick it in the mail. You know, I'm hoping against hope that laziness on the part of Democrats is not the reason that this happens and Newsom is recalled. I mean, if people don't like Newsom, that's fine. There's going to be an election next year. So
right.
If they can primary him, do whatever, but please don't do this. You know, it would be absolutely nuts if California did it. Very bad for the country. You can imagine Mitch McConnell being able to completely torpedo Biden's agenda at the hands of California. I mean, would that anything make him happier than that? And that is certainly something that's possible if this thing happens.
Let alone Larry Elder is the person leading in the polls who would replace Gavin Newsom if this were the case. And so, you know, what's scary, not I think is the complacency, which is scary, or laziness, if the word isn't getting out there, because I think I spoke with someone about this before who said that they feel like there's fatigue after the Trump years and people aren't paying attention in the way that there should be. They should be. Right now on 538, the average of polls only has keeping Gavin Newsom in office at plus 1.2%, which is a scary figure. And then you have Larry Elder, who's leading the pack to replace him. That would be disastrous. And he doesn't have the name recognition of an Arnold Schwarzenegger, for example.
Right.
But he's a celebrity in his own right. He's a right-wing talk show host who has been taking pointers from white supremacists. So for people who may not be familiar with Larry Elder, just talk about him a bit and how scary this guy is.
Oh, he's very scary. He's an LA talk show host. So I've heard him many, many times. And he's appeared on Fox News. So people around the country have probably seen him from time to time. They call on him quite often. He's an African-American right-wing libertarian who, you know, calls himself the sage of South Central, which is really insulting to the people of South Central, who do not agree, generally speaking, with anything that he, you know, espouses as a political philosophy. He is very, very right wing. I mean, this is not somebody who is not, this is not Mitt Romney. It's not Arnold Schwarzenegger, actually, who was, you know, kind of a middle of the road Republican and was known to be someone who sort of crossed. He was married to a Kennedy, you know. I mean, there was definitely, you know, things about him that could appeal to moderates and maybe some conservative Democrats at the time. This guy is very right wing. I mean, he believes in no COVID mitigation, no mask mandates, no vaccines. He's just not someone who is going to be, you know, California's hanging on here with COVID. It's doing pretty well considering how difficult and diverse the population is and how hard it is to reach people. It's doing pretty well, way better than Florida or Texas or some of the other big states that are not doing so well. Larry Elder will be Ron DeSantis when it comes to the COVID in California if he takes over. That's one thing. But just philosophically speaking, I mean, he is, you know, very misogynist. I mean, really, the stuff he has written over the years about women, just, you know, they're too dumb. Or I shouldn't say too dumb. They don't understand politics and don't, you know, read enough to be able to know what it's all about.
Oh, that's much better. That's much better.
Yeah, I know. It makes me feel better. I know that. he has been in recent days, he's been accused by an ex-girlfriend of brandishing a gun at her when they were having problems. And she's actually, I think today, just today, filed some kind of a criminal complaint about him. So that's a bit of a problem, not a problem for right wingers, of course, that's actually a qualification for them. But, you know, his views on women are very, very, very right wing. And, you know, this goes across the board. You know, no taxes. The minute he got in, he would certainly propose, you know, tax cuts for millionaires. I mean, this is, you know, he goes that's the whole, you know, part of his right wing philosophy, probably at the forefront, small government, et cetera. This would be a disaster, not to mention the fact that the guy just really is totally unqualified. There's 40 million people in this country, in this state. It is a big state. It's got the sixth largest economy in the world. It is, not for someone like him who really does not have any experience running anything except maybe a board, you know, an audio board at a radio station, because, you know, this is not a good time. And I would have thought after Donald Trump, that we would have seen that maybe having some experience doing something would have been a qualification. And there are other Republicans on the ballot. I mean, there's a San Diego former mayor, I believe. There's another guy named John Cox who ran against Newsom and lost miserably in 2018. So there are other choices, but they're getting no traction. I mean, Elder is the one, you know, because he's got the celebrity name, I think. And Republicans, from what I've read, are saying it doesn't matter which one you vote for, whether it's Elder or Cox or Falconer, the guy from San Diego, or anybody else on the ballot. We don't care who becomes governor. We just want Newsom out, which tells you everything about how nihilistic they really are, because this is just a political game to them. It has nothing to do with issues. And, you know, I mean, California has issues, no doubt about it. I mean, it's a big state and it's got a lot of problems, which I'm sure all the states in the country do, certainly the big cities, with homelessness, housing costs, and various things like that. I mean, this is not a state that is, you know, being run perfectly. Nobody suggests that. But Newsom has done an okay job, and, you know, certainly better than some gadfly talk show host. Now, I should mention Caitlyn Jenner, who she was supposed to be the big front runner, and she's kind of cratered, but she had all the, you know, Donald Trump's brain trust behind her. Brad Parscale was advising her, his former campaign manager. And there was a lot of money that flowed to her, but she decided in the middle of the campaign to go and appear in Australian Big Brother, Celebrity Big Brother. And so she hasn't been campaigning. So that she doesn't seem to be going anywhere, but anything could happen. You know, I mean, we don't know. I mean, what I said before, somebody with 10% of the vote could end up winning the California governorship with this crazy recall thing. So, you know, anything could happen with her, too. She is at least a known name, although I don't know that Republicans are all that enthusiastic about her, probably less so than some Democrats, even though she's a very right wing, very conservative person.
Right. So, right. Yeah. Well, you know, celebrity big brother, governor of California, kind of a lateral move, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, I think maybe, you know, she might be overqualified because she did appear for many years on Keeping Up with the Kardashians. So, you know, that completely, you know, I mean, she should be running for president, honestly. I mean, that's really where her next step.
Right. With that level of experience, luckily, I mean, she is kind of being treated as a joke. And from my understanding, she's just run on complete resentment towards homeless and poor people.
Yes.
which you know is not above the Republican Party, but you know, Larry Elder isn't much better. So hopefully getting the word out about just voting no on the first question is key, because then, you know, that then hopefully if enough people do that, we're going to be able to stop this from happening, especially in California. A lot of my friends there are a bit worried, but I think the word's getting out a little bit more recently.
It is. I'm seeing a lot more signs. I'm seeing much more stuff on TV. And California is a tough political environment in any case to for anybody to get any word out. TV has to be blanketed, which they're doing, but it can't just be TV. They have to be out there with signs, door knocking, all that stuff, phone banking. And I'm seeing that happen. So hopefully, fingers crossed, the word gets out over the next 2 weeks that, you know, people all have their ballots now. So all they have to do is open it up and, you know, fill it out and throw it in the mail. And hopefully people will actually, you know, do that one small action to save the state and the country from this really awful, awful development if it happens.
Right. Let's talk about Afghanistan then, a bit of a turn, because as I mentioned, the 31st is approaching. That's the deadline that Biden has set and says he's going to stick to it in terms of fully getting out of Afghanistan. And this has been a very bizarre dynamic to see the coalescence of the media in unified critique of Biden. And it's reflected in his poll numbers, despite the fact that withdrawal from Afghanistan is a popular position. The media line is, well, you know, it's the way he did it. There's not really alternatives presented about how to do it. It's more just let's remain there a bit longer. What is your take on this? Because Republicans are pouncing on this. This does seem to have an effect. And even anecdotally, people I spoke to who like Biden, more normie Democrats in my life, they're criticizing him on this. And I'm in the position of defending Biden, which is not often the position that I'm in, Heather.
Well, I mean, I feel the same way, and I have the same experience as you with this. I mean, I don't suggest in any way that this is a pretty picture that's happening. It's absolutely horrifying. It really is. I mean, the sight of seeing people lined up desperate to get out of the country. You know, there was this bombing that happened, you know, with mass casualties. This is an awful, awful situation, but I was not under the impression that this thing was going to end in some orderly fashion with the last American soldier getting on the plane, saluting smartly. And that's the end of that. I mean, I don't know who thought that, but they were deluding themselves if they did. I mean, consider the counterfactual. Let's suppose that happened. And all these people who are now crying for the Afghan people, which is totally appropriate. They've been completely screwed in this situation. They really have. But, you know, imagine if we had the soldier had had saluted smartly, gotten on the plane and left. What we were expecting at that point was a bloody civil war between the Afghan army that we had trained and the Taliban. Now, how that is supposed to have been a great thing for the Afghan people, I do not know. That was the good, you know, that was the positive and good outcome that supposedly these people wanted, was for the Afghan army to hold off the Taliban long enough for us to get out and get all of our friends out and then fight to the death for control of Afghanistan. And to me, that just does not seem to be that much better than what we are seeing. In fact, it's probably a lot worse. There would have been horrible bloodshed if that were to happen. So the fact that the Taliban, who everyone expected to take over, this is not a surprise at all. Nobody can claim that they thought the Afghan army was going to hold off the Taliban, because nobody believed it. It happened sooner rather than later without a bloody civil war. The weeks that we are spending here at the very end trying to airlift people out, and they've airlifted out a tremendous number, which, you know, I don't think we can ignore. I mean, that's a pretty amazing accomplishment that they were able to get so many people out so quickly. That is, you know, I mean, it's ugly. It is complicated. It is certainly something that no one wants to look at, right? I mean, I don't think anybody is looking at this and thinking, wow, that's really terrific, everything that's happening. But there were no good options. No matter what was going to happen, Afghanistan was going to be in a horrible situation. The best we can hope for now And the best we could ever hope for, really, would be to get out our friends and get out and not have a tremendous amount of bloodshed afterwards. Whether the Taliban decides to enact retribution on their former enemies, I don't know. I mean, I assumed it. I think everybody assumed they were going to do that. That is what they did back in the 90s when they took over, and it was a horrific thing. But, you know, maybe they've changed. I mean, people say that maybe they've become more pragmatic and they want to have access to international funds and institutions, et cetera. They want to run a real country. Maybe that's going to happen. I don't know. I mean, hope is not a plan, but it's all we've got, because the truth is they were always going to take over. So my feeling about this is that the media has just immediately launched into just a reflexive sort of pro-war stance. And I, you know, I mean, we all saw that. Well, maybe you didn't. You're a lot younger than me, but in 2000,
I've done my best to beef up my knowledge, and you'd be surprised how much of a dork I was at a young age.
I can believe it, not because you seem dorky at all today, but you're a smart person, so I'm sure you were paying attention.
Appreciate it.
And in early, you know, when this happened after 2001, you know, the media, it was an unbelievable sort of, you know, bandwagon that took place. I mean, I have never seen anything like that. And in fact, it's one of the reasons why I started writing about politics rather late in life, because I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And it had to do specifically with Afghanistan and then, of course, Iraq. But, you know, which was actually Afghanistan part two. And the media just, this is a reflex with them. The minute the flag waving starts and there's some kind of violence and soldiers involved, they just completely lose all perspective. And we've seen that in these last few days. I mean, this is a replay of 2001 and the way that they behaved. And one of the main reasons why we got in and got stuck there, because every president knew this was going to happen. No matter how, anybody who left was going to be facing this kind of criticism, the blowback from Republicans, the media scrutiny that's just absolutely ruthless. They knew they were going to be facing that, and none of them had the courage to do it. And, you know, like you, I, you know, wasn't a big Joe Biden supporter. I mean, you know, I mean, he was not my first choice. I'll just put it that way. But I give him credit for having the guts to actually say, I'm doing it anyway. I know this is going to happen. And he saw it, you know, when he was in the Obama administration, when people were, you know, pressing Obama hard to stay in, and Obama actually escalated the war in Afghanistan as a result of this pressure, because it's tremendous.
And also Obama ran on let's go back to the good war, right? The Iraq
war.
And that was we were so desperate for a Democrat at that moment, especially he was in contrast to Hillary Clinton, who supported the Iraq war. So, you know, the Iraq war was so egregious that his politics in that time were very welcome, especially on, I think, from my perspective at that moment, on the Democratic stage. And something that we on the progressive left saw as a opportunity to just divert away from the horrors of the Bush administration. But in retrospect, having an anti-war position is the correct position, not a good war versus a bad war. And
And
I can't believe I'm saying this, but this was brave by Biden, because he anticipated the blowback, as you say. And he's not backing down from it, as if I were to have guessed before this happened, I would have anticipated that he would. And he's really, his numbers are taking a hit because of this manufactured outrage without any context that's being blasted all across all of the airwaves and in the print press. And I'm curious about what you think about this dynamic, because to me, it's so clear that these national security reporters, especially, they have relationships with people in Langley. They have relationships with people in the intelligence community, their sources. And like, they have convinced themselves, all of them, that this is the unimpeachable truth. And the outrage is totally justified because they have this symbiotic relationship with the intelligence community. And it's so insular and specific and not based in any broader context. It's maddening to watch.
Absolutely maddening. You are so right. And when you think about it, look, Joe Biden, unlike Obama, ran on withdrawal from Afghanistan. Donald Trump ran on withdrawal from Afghanistan. This was almost, I mean, there was virtually no discussion in the press about this. It was just a given that it was going to happen. Now, I have my doubts that Donald Trump would have actually done it. I mean, I have a feeling that they were able to manipulate him into staying. They did it throughout 4 years. But nonetheless, the consensus across both parties, it was one bipartisan agreement that it was time to get out of Afghanistan. And now they're kind of hedging and saying, well, we think it's that we should get out, but this is, he's doing it wrong, you know, which is also a cop out, right? I mean, that's just that you can always find a reason to say that it wasn't done properly rather than the fact that he actually took the step that everybody knew was, and this is the truth, everybody knew it was going to be bad. I mean, there was no way to do this in a way that wouldn't be bad because the Taliban are horrible and we knew that they were going to take over. So in that context, there was no other way than bad to do it. It was just a matter of choosing one and then sticking to your guns. And I agree with you. I think all these national security reporters and all the, you know, they've got all these generals out there again. They've got H.R. McMaster saying that we surrendered to the Taliban, you know, all this stuff. It's the same old crowd. And it's the same crowd that was there in 2001 agitating to go in. I mean, these are the same people. This is the, you know, the Ike's military industrial complex. By the way, many of these generals who are on TV now are also working for defense contractors. And let's not forget that the trillions of dollars that were spent on Afghanistan over the last 20 years, most of it went to defense contractors. So, you know, this is that there is this whole world there, as you point out, of this national security state that exists, you know, specifically around the war on terrorism, in which case I should note Spencer Ackerman's new book, Reign of Terror, really, really good if you want to look at this. And just really delves into this whole, you know, aspect of this story. But, you know, this whole thing has been, you know, it's been the same people the whole time. And by the way, the media is part of it. And, you know, there are stories being written, by the way, if people are reading the New York Times, there was a story last week by the Kabul bureau chief of the New York Times. Absolutely excellent, giving thorough context and a lot of detail that you never are going to see on CNN or read in a front page New York Times story. Just yesterday, there was a story about Pakistan and its role in this whole thing. Very interesting and very important to understand because the power dynamics in the region have, you know, dictated a whole lot of, you know, where we are. The upshot being that there's a lot to this story. It's very complicated. And yet these people always reduce it back down to, you know, some kind of bathos and pathos for the people, all of which is appropriate simply because they are, you know, most of the people in Afghanistan are not responsible for what's happened. But at the same time, you know, that doesn't tell the story, and it doesn't tell the story of the United States and its ongoing imperial hubris in doing this sort of thing. I mean, I'm old enough to have lived through two of these now, these ridiculous, you know, forever decades long wars that end up with people being, you know, evacuated out of the country and the whole thing falling apart. I mean, at some point, God help us, are we going to learn? I mean, I don't know.
We're not learning on the framing of it. They're talking about this as a Saigon moment, right? Like, yeah. as if the horror is the withdrawal and mm-hmm. not the decades in the case of Afghanistan and the years in Vietnam that preceded it. The horror exactly. that was set, the horror that this press and media critique is easy, but in this instance, I think it's instrumental to talk about because, like, in issues of war and peace, they are the buffer between the powers that yes. be and the truth getting to the American people. The withdrawal is not the horror. The imperialism that set the stage and the death that preceded it is the horror. And how yes. can you not frame it as such?
Absolutely. Well, they can do that because it, you know, prosaic, you know, opportunistic way, it preserves their relationships with people that you were talking about that are involved in the national security state. And in another way, it's simple. It's easy to understand. You know, I mean, this gets their, you know, their patriotic flag waving, you know, impulse going. And the American people feel that way too. Yeah. You know, I hate to say it, but you know, the Americans are very easily manipulated on this. Their belief in the absolute, you know, omnipotent power of their military is ridiculous, and the omnipotent power of America. I mean, I don't know when we're going to learn that we can't do everything, and we can't really do a lot of things like this, mainly because of our power. You know, this is a giant stomping into some, you know, complicated situation, and we've never been able to do much with that. I mean, it's a lesson that we can't seem to learn, but Americans, you know, egoism kind of, you know, it makes it easy for it to be presented that way, that, you know, this is a failure. You know, Joe Biden came in and ruined everything, which is just, it's so absurd. I can't even wrap my mind around it. You know, he's been in office for 7 months. He's doing what he said he was going to do. And he was elected with everybody knowing that he wanted to get out of Afghanistan. He had very strong personal reasons for wanting to do it. And we all knew that. And yet somehow or another, this is, you know, now considered to be some kind of major error. I suspect that this is not going to be something that will actually hurt him, his standing over the long term. Because the reason is this. I think Americans, for all of their kind of shame at not being able to do this perfectly, really want to get out of Afghanistan.
Yes.
I mean, even on that side, I think, you know, on both sides of the partisan aisle, we are not seeing a whole lot of, you know, there's some drop in the numbers of Afghanistan withdrawal, but not much. The people are tired of war and they want it over. So in the end, I think people will come to accept what has happened. And if we can do right by the Afghan refugees, a subject for another day. If we can do right by them and basically, you know, sort of act in a moral fashion at the end of this in that regard, I think that Joe Biden will end up being seen as a man of courage for having the courage to actually do this.
Yeah. And the refugee conversation, as you say, conversation for another day, but part of our effort will have to be to stave off the Republican racism that's already percolating about, you know, bringing terrorists in, suicide bombers. But again, Heather Parton, her blog is called Hullabaloo. Thank you so much, Heather, for your time today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
This summer, the remains of hundreds of Indigenous children were found in Canada at one of the Indian residential schools that were responsible for the deaths and mistreatment of countless First Nation children, and the numbers have been seemingly undercounted by the Canadian government specifically. But this has sparked yet another conversation about genocide and colonialism in North America. The awful effects extend beyond these instances at these residential schools, and we still have a long way to go to reckon with that history, let alone repair it. And here to talk about this is Guyan Hia'a, Executive Director of the American Indian Law Alliance, whose piece in The Nation is entitled Truth and Justification on the Cruelties Against Indigenous People. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for doing this today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's first just talk about these incredibly awful revelations over the summer about these residential schools, which we've known for a while, but The unmarked graves being found just kind of was another gut punch to also restart this conversation a bit. Talk really about these revelations and how this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, I think what happened for me personally was that it was a culmination of all these different things. I've done a lot of work in the past on the doctrine of discovery and understanding, like, you know, processes of domination, hierarchical systems, why white supremacy exists. And of course, it's the core, right? Doctrine of discovery is the core of all of that. And then when this came up about, you know, these unmarked graves of thousands upon thousands, you know, there are over 2,500 now that have been found in Canada. They haven't even started in the United States. And so that reckoning for them is coming, and we knew that it, you know, existed. And that was certainly well intended to eliminate us, really, you know. Even here, you know, I think I said this to you before, was that William Pratt said, or Richard Pratt, excuse me, said, kill the Indian and save the man. And when I say that out loud, right, you know, how that reverberates back to me, and how that feels. And then in a broader context, thinking about how this has affected my own family. My grandfather was forced to go to Carlisle, as his mother was as well. And my grandmother was forced to go to a Catholic school. And so it's so strange that all of this is happening now, because she just started talking about it. She's 98 years old. And so I can't even imagine how difficult it was for her to come to that, just to even be able to express it.
To deal with that trauma, it must have taken enormous courage, and also just like an understanding or grappling with the concept that the colonizers took so much, right? I mean, it's not just reading about it in history. And as a white woman, I can't understand this experience. I want to, though. Like, what that must feel like for it to be. That history to be within you and to be held in your trauma. I mean, and I think that that's something that white Americans in this country cannot understand.
Yes. I mean, I was on a committee about removing the Columbus statue, and one of the participants of this Columbus committee said to me, well, I went to a boarding school and it was great. And I had that minute when I was like, wait a minute. Like,
Oh my God.
We're not even talking about the same, kind of boarding school where your parents are paying for you to go to some elite school. This isn't even close to what we're talking about. Our children were ripped away from their mother. Imagine being a mother and having your children taken from you. And when they're returned, they are something that you don't even recognize, and that they don't even recognize you, right? There is no, and really what it was that our grandparents, those parents, the kids that came back, their parents had gone to boarding school. So there wasn't like senses of like affection, love, because it was beaten out of us, right? My partner, who is a spiritual leader of our Six Nations, often talks about how his mother never hugged him and how painful an experience that was. And how this came about with my grandmother was, she was sitting down telling me what she thought, what a wonderful mother I was. And how all of her regrets because of what had happened to her in relationship to her relationship with my mother. And so, you know, it's such, like you said, it's so intertwined in the core of who we are, not like historical trauma, generational trauma, and then the trauma that we bring on ourselves, right? Or in, within, not that we bring it on ourselves, but the that we experience and that we live through. You know, and it's so hard without that acknowledgement and healing. How do you move forward from that? I mean, it was clear genocide. That was the purpose of all of that. And even to wrap that my head around that, and to be able to have to say this to my own children, you know, that's the intent. You need to understand that that's the intent, so that they feel in some kind of way that maybe, you know, why was I not valued? Why were, you know, we as Haudenosaunee people and other indigenous people not valued. We're not seen as human. That all stems from the doctrine of discovery as well.
So before we move on to talking more in depth about this, you know, centuries long doctrine of discovery and the ideology that allowed for or excused in the colonizer's mind genocide and drove it forward, in fact, I just want people to get a sense of what happened at these residential schools, why there were mass graves of children. Mm. Because I don't think, I mean, you gave that example of that person on your board, right? Or who you spoke to said, oh, I went to a boarding school. This was not a boarding school. This was mass institutionalized child abuse under the guise of religion. Yes. I mean, it's so just give people a sense of what that was.
So, you know, they would be taken, ripped away from their community, taken to these boarding schools. And, you know, their clothes, the traditional, if I could stand up, you'd see that I'm wearing a ribbon skirt now, took away our traditional manner of dress. And then forced, you know, this forced assimilation of, you know, dressing like I guess a Caucasian person, cutting our young men's hair, shaving their head, beating them for speaking their language. One young man talked about, not young man, one man when he was a child talks about being forced by a nun to eat his own vomit in front of his brother. And then the sexual abuse that occurred at such a high level. I mean, like it was like nonstop. It was almost like a daily occurrence, right? And haunting images, you can look up R.G. Miller, who's a great artist who put in all of his artwork, you know, about what happened to him at a residential school, which was called Mushbowl. Like that was, you know, their name for it, Mushbowl. And the haunting images of that daily abuse, that daily, you know, being starving, being hungry. I mean, there's still a boarding school alive today out in California called the Sherman Boarding School. And those kids don't even have enough to eat. I mean, and this is a government-run institution. And let alone the fact that, you know, they've been sent there because they have generations of trauma from their parents going to boarding schools. Now you're talking about alcoholism, drug addiction to try to deal with the pain that they have. And then coming back home with all of these abusive, because that's what they were taught was, you know, the abuse.
It was abuse, right? From the trauma. Mm-hmm. And the mass murders of these children.
Yes. Mass murders.
Mm-hmm. Right. Is there any understanding of, well, one, I know that the Canadian government has found over 2,000 deaths, yeah, right? But that's clearly an undercount. You know, is there any understanding of how these children died? Was it just the result of beatings because of insubordination or perceived, you know, insubordination to the teachers, or what was it?
Some of it was that. Some of it was, you know, different viruses that our bodies aren't used to dealing with or handling, just because we're not around them or familiar to them, you know, things like, you know, smallpox, the flu, all of those things that we don't have a natural fight against, that our immune system is not built up to handle that. And so, you know, it's a very different kind of thing. So it was all of that, right? Some of it was like forced abortions on young girls that got pregnant by these priests. I mean, it's horrifying, absolutely horrifying. And I can't imagine, you know, this one man that lives on our nation, Virgil Braverock, who said that when he went to school, there were like over 200 people on his floor. And then when it was all said and done, there was only 11 of them left. I mean, how do you account for the generations that have now been lost because of that, right? All under the guise of this doctrine of domination. You know, it's so intertwined in this culture that's what's running the United States right now. You know, this right. Hierarchical system, this domination, these systems of domination that permeate every aspect of our lives.
And that pairs, I guess, well with the explanation, if I could ask this of you, of the doctrine of Christian discovery, which was a huge part of our colonial ideology. Explain that to people who may not be familiar, if you could.
Certainly. So the doctrine of discovery was a papal bulls of the 15th century that basically gave Christian explorers the right to claim lands that were like discovered, right? And lay claim to those lands for their Christian monarchs. And so any land that wasn't inhabited by Christians were available for this discovery. And that meant that it could be taken, you know, as I always say, either, you know, through acts of death, torture, rape, murder, all these things, right? And if they couldn't convert those people that are living there, that they would be enslaved or killed. And frankly, they would have been enslaved and killed anyway. And it's really like the root cause of what's plaguing our peoples and the peoples of the world and our Mother Earth, the notion held that an exercises law that we are somehow less than human and therefore have no rights to land and resources. And you can see this really clearly in South America now. I mean, of course, you can see it here with all the pipelines, the extractive industries, Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. And basically will forcefully displace our people off their lands and desecrate sacred sites, all in the thirst for gold, really, is what I call it, you know?
Under the guise of Christianity, but it's just conquering for enrichment. And like that is, it's insanely hypocritical because at least, you know, religion is supposed to be this force for love and understanding, but really it was a way to create systems of capital that benefited these white European settlers. We have to take a quick break, but when I come back, I want to expand on this and how incredibly, this is so omnipresent in the way that we have a relationship with Indigenous people in this country and in Canada and just in North America in general to this day. We'll be right back. So before we broke, we were just talking about how the doctrine of Christian discovery as a extension of colonial ideology is still a part of our relationship with Indigenous people in America and in North America in general to this day. A great example of that is these pipeline fights that we're seeing throughout the country. I was at Dakota Access Pipeline at least four times during those protests with water protectors. And in Canada, we have, you know, there's Justin Trudeau presents himself as a liberal. He has approved a variety of different projects that cut into Indigenous land as he does these things like the, you know, truth and reconciliation process where they're trying to, you know, reckon with Canada's history of implementing these genocidal policies at the same time continuing this very concept, albeit in a more sanitized modern form, but this is the same, it's of the same vein, these pipelines. Talk about that as a continuation of the very colonial concepts that we were unpacking before.
So yes, because, you know, because the US and Canada have come in and taken over many of the resources, what people don't know is that many of the resources that are left are on Indigenous lands. And so if, you know, the governments are now agreeing because they have an investment, they have an invested benefit by extracting resources from these different territories and then putting in these awful pipelines, you know, and there's not even enough energy in the ground, you know, for all these pipelines. I mean, why aren't they taking these pipelines and using them in Flint, Michigan? Or, I mean, I just find this so appalling. And it doesn't just affect, this doctrine of discovery doesn't just affect Indigenous people. It affects, you know, anyone, minority, especially African-Americans. And so, you know, these pipelines are an extension of that domination. And they're so embedded, financially invested in other countries. You know, Canada is invested in Mexico, invested in South America to get, you know, extract. And so is the United States to extract all of these minerals from the ground. And they will do it at all cost. And so you see militarization happening in different Indigenous territories. And we face felony, we face death, beatings. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like our lives are not even valued at this basic level. So yes, it's definitely a problem. And I laugh about Canada's truth and reconciliation. You can't reconcile over 500 years of genocide when that genocide is like still continuing and you're still part of it. you know, like, and yet certainly you just can't reconcile it. So what is the path forward? You know, like, you know, stop that.
Stop the pipeline.
What is happening? What you're
right. Right.
Like, you know what
would be a bit of a reconciliation token, like something to show that you're serious about this, perhaps halt these pipeline projects that cut across indigenous lands and contaminate the water supply and contaminate the ground. Perhaps respect the legal treaties that have been agreed upon. I don't know.
Yes, exactly right. And that's what's happening, you know, like for us to defend it. I've had people ask me, when did you become an activist? And I'm like, I mean, I didn't realize that was even a choice. You know, you're born, you're indigenous. Therefore you have an obligation to speak for all living beings that can't speak for themselves. That's our mandate as indigenous people. That's what we are expected to do. And so we have to fight for Mother Earth. And if people don't get it now with the acceleration of climate change and this climate crisis, you know, I don't know when they're going to get it. I mean, it's really an equalizer, what's happening right now. So people think that they're safe because they have money, they have power, some false sense of power and prestige, right? It's like a deck of cards and it's all going to fold in. And so for me, it's like wanting to offer people our value system, you know, that these things aren't like the things that you value aren't really valuable. It's like, look around outside you, clean water, air. I mean, you have to have these things to live, you know, and I don't know where common sense ends up. It just kind of goes out the window.
Well, I mean, when there's profit to be had, people kind of become temporarily insane, or at least systemically insane, when you look at the way that we've responded in this country and in Canada as well. We haven't touched that much on the United States. I want to talk about the U.S.'s culpability. Like, we can laugh at the Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is, yes, in many ways a sham and isn't going to be sufficient as they approve pipelines, but the United States hasn't done anything even close to that, which is unbelievable given our history.
They haven't even,
Right, exactly.
Haven't even started yet. Yeah, I think that's what I find really appalling, and I'm hoping that Deb Haaland can, you know, apply some pressure, I guess, to the administration to take notice and, you know, to do something about it. But I don't know that it's on his agenda or, you know, on his radar that's that important to him, you know, and all the people that are in those offices. It's hard unless it affects you personally, right? I mean, I will say again, yes, they did take this ridiculous step for truth and reconciliation. And you're right, at least they did that. And the U.S. is so far behind in all of that. And I think that the reason that they're far behind is because they understand that it's more than just saying, I'm sorry, right? For them, it's dollars and cents. You can't put a price on my grandfather's life that was ruined, right? Or the abuse and the effects that it had on my mother and then my mother to us, right? I mean, you cannot put a price on that stuff. And so I don't understand, I guess, why they are so afraid to have the discussion, other than for them it means it's a monetary thing and it's about land. I'm just waiting for them to do the right thing, which, you know, we'll probably be waiting for an eternity. But all of this, it affects everything. I mean, all future generations, if this isn't met and acknowledged and dealt with in a meaningful way, my children and their children, they're going to be dealing with it as well.
Are you in favor of reparations to an extent?
I don't think that indigenous people see it the same way. Like, reparations to us, like, you can't just throw money at us and that be sufficient. That's not what's going to fix it. Some land back, yes. And then conversations about how to move forward. And I think that they're just really afraid of the shame that it will bring about the conversations and the truths that are going to be told over the next, you know, few decades. I mean, and they should be afraid, right?
Right.
You know, the Catholic Church, you know, I just met with a bishop in Syracuse today, a group of us, and he's very open to having these conversations. The first time that I've ever heard, you know, a bishop being open to that. And so, you know, they're really hard steps, and it's about education and understanding, like even what happened at the Capitol, January 6th, you know, how entrenched in the doctrine that is, those viewpoints of domination, Christian domination, of white supremacy, of, you know, how intertwined that is in every aspect of our being. And if people could understand it, they could start unwinding it, right? They could start to unravel this web of lies that have been told, the history that's been denied.
So you mentioned the Catholic Church there. I know the Pope has spoken about it briefly, but can you talk a little bit about their culpability as an organization in what happened here?
Yes. I mean, they're hugely culpable. And, you know, although he acknowledged pain, right? Like it always falls short. It never extends to like what actually really happened and identifying it, giving it a voice. And so, you know, their days of having a moral authority are over. They no longer, now that all of these truths have come out, right? All of the abuses, the sexual abuse scandal, you know, what they did to Indigenous children, like you can no longer sit in a position of moral authority. And I think that's the one thing that I'm so tired of. This attitude that if you're not Christian, I literally had somebody say to me, well, Betty, you know, we were just trying to save souls. And I said, no, our souls are not the ones that need to be saved.
Right.
Okay. I mean,
it's so arrogant. And we should say, I didn't introduce you as Betty, but your colonized name is Betty Lyons. And
yes.
I mean, I even am curious about your approach to that name, because even that carries such weight and trauma, because inherently within that name is a complete memory or ghost of the colonization.
You're absolutely right. It is. And it is very difficult. And so what I'm seeing now are a lot of mothers giving their kids, you know, their original name, the name, you know, from their clan, as they should, instead of taking on a colonized name. And I love that, right? I was born in a different generation when, you know, I'm 51. And so I was born in a generation when that didn't happen. And so for me, although, you know, when we're babies, we're taken to the longhouse and our clan mother, I'm a Snipe clan of the Onondaga Nation. Our clan mother gives you your name, and your name is also related to the earth. So my name means small sky. Ganya'at means small sky. My son, my oldest son, is Onegino, which means cold water. Our other son is Dehahuwakwak, which means he lifts up the canoe. And so they're so intertwined in the fabric of life, and they're so much more meaningful. Although I will say that my name, I was named after my grandmother, and so we're matrilineal. And so, you know how you hear about men, oh, this is so-and-so, the first, the second, the third. Well, it's kind of that way for us, even with English names, you know, non-Indigenous names, we have a tendency to name our kids after our mothers, grandmothers, and the women in our family. So it's kind of a weird thing that we kind of incorporated into it. So, yeah.
We kind of share that. I was named after my great grandmother, so I've got a little bit of that in me.
Good for you.
Yes.
Like
well, I really appreciate your time today, because I've been wanting to have somebody on the show to talk about specifically the revelations over the residential schools, but having a broader discussion about repair for what we've done to Indigenous communities in this country and in North America in general was very important. So I really appreciate it. Gayan Hia'a, she's the executive director of the American Indian Law Alliance. You can read her piece in The Nation. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
I appreciate the platform in which you gave us to speak today, too, because no other media source other than The Nation is covering it. NBC, that's it. So thank you.
Thank you. That's it for this week's Ring of Fire podcast. If you're listening to the free show right now, you're missing all the bonus content our members enjoy on a weekly basis. Go to rofpodcast.com now and become a member. It's your support that keeps us moving forward. On behalf of Heather Parton, I'm Emma Vigeland. Have a great weekend.